Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. How are you? I'm joined in studio this afternoon by my team of producers, Rebecca Maxwell and Carissa Rogers. I am so thankful for the faithful support of all the listeners, but also these amazing women that run the show and make me look surprisingly organized. Every week, I'm so grateful for the time we have together every day to dig into the Word of God and have the Holy Spirit teach, lead, and guide us.
So as we're celebrating these days of Christmas and scurrying around returning the gifts that don't fit or light up the way they're supposed to, let us remember the simple gift of the little drummer boy.
Without a gift for the infant Jesus, the little drummer boy played his drum with Jesus' mother Mary's approval, recalling, "I played my best for him, and he smiled at me." So let us listen to some of our guests on the show this year that we've enjoyed so much. Our finest gifts we bring. Pa-rum-pa-pum-pum.
Come, they told me, pa-rum-pum-pum-pum.
It's almost our anniversary. Join us for a night of comedy with Bill Arnold and the original cast of Triple Espresso as we celebrate 70 years of radio ministry. Michael Pierce Donnelly, Bob Stromberg, and Bill Arnold, the writers and original cast of Triple Espresso, will keep you laughing with a unique comedy show. One night only, 7 p.m. March 16th at the Knight Performance Hall on the campus of the University of Northwestern in St. Paul, Minnesota. Tickets are available now at myfaithradio.com.
Merry Christmas and God's blessing to you in the new year from all of us at Faith Radio. And to the hundreds of friends who pray with and for us each week as members of the prayer team, thank you. Your faithfulness and desire to stand with us in prayer is so encouraging. May you experience God's peace and joy this season because of the hope we have in Jesus. You can join with us on the Faith Radio prayer team and we'll expect great things together in the new year. Just go to myfaithradio.com/prayer to sign up today.
You're listening to Bill Arnold's encore presentation, Faith, Hope, and Clarity in a special repeat performance.
Welcome back to the show. So glad you can join me today. Dr. Tim Keller is my guest. He's written a book called The Prodigal Prophet, Jonah and the Mystery of God's Mercy. He's the former pastor, founder of Redeemer Church in New York. So he's with me today. Hello, Dr. Keller. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Great to be with you.
When I was reading your book, The Prodigal Prophet, I was realizing that, boy, you really helped fill in a lot of dots on the story of Jonah. So I'd love to talk to you about some of those. First of all, I wasn't even registering that he was the first Hebrew prophet to leave Israel to go preach to a Gentile city.
Yeah. There may be somebody else we don't know, but we don't know. But
yeah.
As far as the Bible's concerned, he's the only one, actually, until Jesus' time, who was sent out. Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Isaiah, and Amos, they all speak to the pagan nations. They actually have oracles or messages, but there's no indication they actually left and went there to preach. So we can kind of see why Jonah was so shocked at the commission.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder why God would want to warn Nineveh. I mean, the capital of this Assyrian empire. I didn't know how cruel and vicious they were.
Yes, well, see, you're wondering the same thing. We need to be a little more sympathetic to Jonah than we are. I think when you first hear the story, say, "Oh my goodness, you know, he's disobeying God. Come on, you know, get it together." There.
Oh, totally.
But they were very violent people, very wicked people. B, no prophet had ever been sent out to go preach because the chances of getting killed on a mission like that were pretty high. And so when you add it all up, it's not a big shock that Jonah was shocked. In the end, of course, he shouldn't have disobeyed God, but we ought to be a little more sympathetic.
Yeah, I mean, not to mention the threat of his death could have been quick. Yeah. I didn't know how vicious they were. They're almost like ISIS, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be a little careful about lining up contemporary things with ancient things. Yeah, they were like a terrorist nation.
Yeah,
basically,
yeah.
They were like a terrorist nation.
Yeah, So Jonah is pegged to go and preach to really the very people he hated the most.
That's right. You might say, he might have said, why in the world? And, of course, at the end, he says that. He says in Jonah chapter 4, he says, the reason I ran away was I was afraid you'd have mercy on these people, and I don't want them. I don't want them to be saved. I want them to be judged.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Tim, didn't the prophet Nathan say that God would destroy Nineveh for its evil? So didn't that make sense to Jonah?
Yeah.
Like, what's the whole point of this?
Yeah. Yeah, the prophet Nahum actually... there's a little bit of debate because Nahum and Jonah were both prophets around the same time. But I looked at the scholarship and I felt the arguments saying that Nahum had preached before Jonah the pretty strong, which means Jonah would have known that God had prophesied that he was going to destroy Nineveh. So why in the world should Jonah go and talk to them? And, of course, the answer was that God was going to judge Assyria. But in the meantime, he actually did have some reason why he wanted Jonah to go, and he did do some good work in that society. But Jonah thought he knew better. He thought, well, I see what God said, and therefore there's a contradiction here. It's like God is contradicting himself. Nahum said he was going to get judged. You're sending me off. And we're often like that, I'm afraid. In our daily lives, we say, what God's doing doesn't seem to make sense to me. And then we get very angry about it, exactly like Jonah.
Yeah, so when Jonah decides he's going to go to Tarshish and he then goes into the bottom of the boat and falls asleep, do you think there's a little bit of feeling sorry for himself, low-level depression, I just want out of this? What is your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, sleeping in a storm, it's not got to be that easy. the boat's rocking. This is not a big ocean liner, by the way.
So right.
It would have been – he must have been exhausted. And you can speculate again, but surely running away from God, maybe guilt, maybe shame, maybe anger at God, maybe self-doubt, am I doing the right thing? All those things means he was just totally drained. And so, again, I'm a little sympathetic, even though he's doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. When I look at Mark chapter 4 and verse 38, when Jesus is asleep with his head on a pillow and there's a raging storm, and I thought of those two episodes, and I thought, if I drift off to sleep on a plane, they hit a little turbulence, I'm wide awake all of a sudden. And I was always wondering how you could be sleeping during those periods of raging storm.
Well, only if you have... been exhausted, only if you have done something that's very wearying. And of course, all travel in those days was a lot more arduous than it is now.
Sure.
But in Jonah's case, he was also probably spiritually drained by what he was doing. He was a prophet,
mm-hmm.
disobeying a direct order from God.
Mm-hmm.
Surely he didn't do that lightly. That would have been very difficult. It must have been all kinds of inner turmoil going on.
Yeah. I loved him in your book, The Prodigal Prophet. You talk about how storms are always attached to sin. You know, if we violate our design, they strike back.
Yes. Now, by the way, just to clarify, I said not all storms are caused by sin, but all sin causes storms. And what I meant is,
yes,
for example, in John chapter 9, so there's a place where the people say, look at this man born blind. Did he sin or his parents sin? That he was born blind, and Jesus says, no, neither, but rather he was born blind so we could show the glory of God. I mean, in other words, the Bible does not say that if bad things happen to you, it's directly because you sin, but it does say if you sin, there are always natural consequences. That is, and I get some examples in there, the Bible says forgive. If you don't forgive, you're not just sinning against God, but you're actually creating all kinds of bitterness in yourself. You might actually have you may undermine your own health with your anger. So that's the idea behind saying there's always a storm attached to sin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate you clarifying that. I hope I didn't get that wrong. But when we talk about running from God, you've got in chapter 10, which I think is so brilliantly laid out, how we have a hard time trusting God because we don't really know if he's out for our happiness. Maybe you would talk about that because that was, I think that chapter really resonated with me. I work a lot with people in drug addiction, and they just don't think they can trust God to be with their happiness.
Right. Well, what I try to say is if you go all the way back to the beginning of the Bible, how did the very first temptation work? So Satan comes in the form of a serpent, and Adam and Eve say, well, you know, we're not allowed to eat of this tree. And the serpent basically says, oh, but if you eat of this tree, you have no idea how great that's going to be. And, you know, God's trying to hold you down, and he's trying to hem you in, and you need to take matters in your own hands. So you might say the very first temptation was, if you trust God, you'll be miserable. And you really can't trust God to have your best interests in mind. That was the first temptation of the Satan. And it's almost like it's passed into our hearts. And it's in every single one of our hearts that we really think, I mean, you just really can't trust God. And if you think about it, it's incredibly arrogant to think that we know better than God, or to think that we know our needs better than God. But that's what sin is. So it's a serious problem, and Jonah shows his mistrust. And the only thing that I think the only thing that heals my mistrust is seeing what Christ did on the cross for me. At that point, I'm saying, if God would do that for me, then I can trust him. I don't think there's anything else that can overwhelm that lie in my heart.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Dr. Timothy Keller. We'll take a very short break and come back in just a minute with more of Dr. Tim Keller.
You're listening to Bill Arnold's encore presentation, Faith, Hope, and Clarity in a special repeat performance.
Welcome back to the show. If you're like me, you are loving this. I've got Dr. Tim Keller on the studio line. So welcome back. So, Tim, I find your book, Tim, so incredibly relevant today with when we look at the people that we are viewing as our enemies or the people that are so different from us. And Jonah was really called to go love the enemies. And I think we've got more partisanship and separation, and we've got we have more walls up than ever before, and we need to drop those, don't we?
Yes, there's no doubt that that's one of the main, it's certainly not the only one, but one of the main messages that ties the book together, if you think of it like this. In Jonah chapter 1 and 2, Jonah runs away, and he does not want to tell the Assyrians the truth. So in the first half, Jonah refuses to tell him the truth. But in the second half, he goes and tells him the truth, but he doesn't do it in love. Because at the very end of the book, God is saying, Jonah, you went to the city, but you didn't love the city. You told him the truth, but you didn't do it in love. There's no compassion in you, Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, if you tell somebody the truth without love, they're never going to believe that truth. They're going to sense that you're just trying to bring them down. The only way you ever get anybody to actually believe the truth is to speak the truth in love. And so if you don't speak the truth in love, you're not actually honoring the truth. You're really not doing the truth. And you're absolutely right. We live in such a time of polarization. It seems to me the second half of the book of Jonah could not be more relevant.
Yeah.
Because it's just saying it's not enough to tell people the truth. You've got to love them. And actually, that's not what we're doing at all.
Mm-hmm. There was a part of your book that really hit home with me because it, and if I can just read this couple sentences that struck me, it said, when you look at people who have brought trouble into their lives by their own foolishness, we say things like, serves them right, or we mock them on social media. What kind of imbecile says something like this? And when we see people of other political party defeated, we gloat. It's not real compassion, is it?
No. Christians are supposed to have the gospel, which pulls them away from that. It does not mean you don't debate. It does not mean you don't tell people the truth. It does not mean you may not be active in a political party. But the gospel pulls you out of that self-righteousness, that it should lift you out of that willingness to demonize the other side and to say they're not just wrong, but they're inferior people because of that. Instead of saying, I'm a sinner too, I'm saved by grace, and show respect to the people who differ with you, and that we should be salt and light in the country right now. But you know, I have to say we're not. I'm afraid increasingly we're pulled into the partisan polarization, and rather than actually helping them, we're I'm afraid being affected by them.
Mm-hmm. I know this gets to be a little bit touchier, but you talk about in your book it's really impossible to transcend politics and just preach the gospel. And I think you made a reference about, you know, slavery in the 1850s. I mean, you couldn't be apolitical, could you?
No. See, if you're apolitical, you're actually voting for the status quo. So if you, even at the local level, if you never go to any kind of community board meetings or neighborhood association meetings, or if you don't participate at all in politics, what you're really saying is the way it is fine. And it's never fine. There's always something wrong. And so to try to not be political is and you end up being political. And so rather than that, if we're going to love our neighbor, we need to be, I think, politically involved. Mm-hmm. But then we have to be careful about being sucked into partisanship too far.
Mm-hmm. Tim, was Jonah a little bit blind to God's grace?
No, he was not a little bit blind to God's grace. He was a lot.
Okay.
Blind to God's grace. So, thank you for that softball question.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
No, in fact, here's the irony is, he can't understand why in the world God would be merciful to these terrible people. So in chapter 4, he's actually standing in front of God saying, this is why I ran the first time away from everything. I mean, I ran away because I knew you might be merciful to these people, and they're terrible. How could you be merciful to those people? So he's standing there. He's a prophet of God. He's already run away, and now he's arguing with God. Why didn't God smite him in the first 3 verses of the book?
Mm-hmm.
And here he's saying, how in the world can you be merciful to these people? And yet there is Jonah living only by God's mercy. I mean, Jonah is only alive because of God's mercy, and he's forgetting that. And therefore, if we speak the truth without love, it's got to be because at that moment we're forgetting that we live only by God's mercy. And I think that's one of the main points of the book. And it's also an ironic thing that here's Jonah arguing you shouldn't be being merciful to them. At that very moment, God's being merciful to him.
So, Tim, when I read the book of Jonah and I see that God sent a storm and then God sent a fish, God's always been in control of all the circumstances in Jonah's life, hasn't he?
That's right. And, of course, the lesson is that bad things and good things. I mean, he sends a plant, you know, at the end of the book. When Jonah's out in the desert and this plant grows up and gives him shade, he sends him a fish, which, of course, is also a thing that actually saves his life. But he also sends a worm to eat the plant, and it dies, and then the sun beats down on Jonah. And so the message is that everything that happens, good and bad, is part of God's will. He doesn't enjoy making us unhappy. But he sometimes does things, allows things, in order to wake us up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, he's in charge of everything.
Mm-hmm. As I just want to go back to the sailors, they were kind of upstaging Jonah a little bit. I mean, Jonah kind of came on and let him know with a little bit of swagger that, you know, who he was and who he followed, and they were pagans. And then after the storm was calmed, they were wanting to know more about God and repenting. And I find that so fascinating that when a storm comes into a person's life, it can get their attention really quickly.
Yes, and of course, that's right. And the sailors are very humble and respectful to Jonah. Even when they find out that he's the cause of the storm, they don't just grab hold of him and throw him overboard. They say, what should we do? They treat him with great respect. And when they see the storm go away, when Jonah's thrown in, They, from what we can tell, they get really converted.
Yeah.
They use the word Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
They offer sacrifices. They are truly converted. And so one of the messages is sometimes the storms come into our life, and it's the only way God can get our attention.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's definitely one of the lessons.
And you and I probably both know, just from experience, of people who have kind of ignored God for much of their life, and then when something came into their life that completely turned it upside down, they were wide open to hearing more about God.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's almost typical. I would say at least more than half of people I know who found Christ have said that they found Christ which is the great treasure, but only because something wrong happened in their life, something bad happened.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, just with a couple of minutes left, would you talk a little bit about the substitutionary sacrifice and the connection between Jonah and Jesus?
Yes. I'm glad you asked about that. The question is, how did Jesus' death save us? One of the things you see in Jonah is the storm comes, and when Jonah says, throw me in, so I will be enveloped by the storm, and you will not be. That is, I'll take what's happening to you, and I'll take it on me. Now, I try to make the case that that's what happens on the cross, but to try to connect it to the way in which we live, I say, if you think about it, all transforming love is like a substitutionary sacrifice. So I try to get some examples. My youngest son and his wife, my youngest son's wife just had twins, and they're like 3 weeks old.
Congratulations.
And right now, yeah, it is wonderful.
Yeah.
You know what it's like to have twins? I mean, they're both infants. They both need to be fed. They don't get up at the same time at night.
Mm-hmm.
And they're exhausted, and they're exhausted. And they're sacrificing everything. They don't go out. They can't do things. It's just the way it is. But if you don't do that, those children don't grow up and have a wonderful life. So even parenting is a substitutionary sacrifice. You say, unless I lose something, you don't gain something. You know, unless I die to my schedule, unless I die to many of the things I'd like to do, you will not live. So I say all of it's like that. But when it comes to Jesus, of course, it's the ultimate example of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultimate example of it is that he died and lost everything so that we might live.
Mm-hmm. Tim, what would be one thing you would hope readers would take away from your book? I got a lot out of it, so thank you for writing it. And what are you hoping readers walk away with?
Well, I listen, that's a great question, but I think I'm going to be a little, I'm going to dodge it a little bit.
Okay.
Because I really believe that the book is so rich that the message you come away with will depend a lot on you, where you are and who you are. It does talk about, for example, really taking God's word seriously,
mm-hmm,
and not reading it selectively. It does talk about trusting God when you don't understand what he's doing. It does talk about not putting your politics over your faith. It does talk about speaking the truth in love. And see, I'm not sure which thing, when you read the book of Jonah, is going to be the main thing that hits you, because it will depend on where you are. But that's because the Word of God is alive and active. It's not a dead book. It's a living power. And depending on where you are and who you are, God will say different things to you through it. And so I'm not sure. I just gave you five or six things that might be taken.
No, I love it.
Depending on where you are, you'll probably get a different thing out of it.
Yeah, I love it. I know you've done a lot of interviews today, so I appreciate you doing one with me. And just always a pleasure to talk to you, and God bless, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Bill. And your questions were really great. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Tim Keller and his book, The Prodigal Prophet, Jonah and the Mystery of God's Mercy. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. Whenever I pick up my banjo, I do it because I want privacy, and I get it. When Kristen Scott Benson picks up hers, magic happens, and people line up to hear it. She is the four-time winner of the IBMA Instrumental Performer of the Year for Banjo. She this year, in 2018, won Steve Martin's Award for Excellence in Banjo. I could go on and on. She's made over 200 appearances on the Grand Ole Opry, and she's had notable performances in front of people like President George W. Bush, and one for Barack Obama. She's made appearances on The Tonight Show, The Late Show with Craig Ferguson, and I could go on and on and on. She's my guest on our studio line. Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
This is so much fun for me. I'm a little too giddy right now, I got to admit.
Well, that's awfully nice. It's always good to talk to somebody who loves the banjo. You know, we have to find a kinship with one another, because there aren't really that many of us in the world.
Yeah, I find that to be true. For the longest time, I thought people didn't like banjo music. It just turns out they didn't like mine. So we've got, you know, having you on the show is going to be fun because we do have a lot of listeners that I know love bluegrass, and I play a lot of banjo on the show. So it's really great to have you, and a lot of your music is going to start drifting onto my show as well. So thank you.
Well, that'll be great. And yeah. I've been surprised. I've played in Minnesota a few times, and there really is a healthy bluegrass music scene in the area. And that's always great when you leave. I live in South Carolina, so very much people perceive it as the hotbed of bluegrass, and it's great when you get to other areas of the country and even the world. And you can tell that there, you know, there's that undercurrent of people who really love bluegrass and the banjo.
Yeah, yeah. Can I start by asking you some of the boring questions that you probably hate getting, as you know, how you all got started in music? Was it a music family you came from?
Yeah, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was a professional musician. He played mandolin as part of a pre-bluegrass duet called Whitey and Hogan. And mm-hmm. they were on the radio on WBT in Charlotte, North Carolina, which was a powerhouse radio station back in the 40s. So I always had his influence there. And he and my grandmother were, you know, certainly pivotal figures in my life, and also the most Christ-like people that I ever knew. And so from the beginning, I associated music with them. And, and that was one of the brightest parts of life for me growing up. And then my dad, you know, just played recreationally, and he liked it too. So I was always around it. It was always available. And I started playing the mandolin when I was 5 and got a banjo for Christmas and started playing it when I was 13.
Now, didn't you fall in love and marry a mandolin player?
I did. And it's really funny because when I started dating Wayne, you know, my grandfather said, well, he's a mandolin player and he's from North Carolina, so he can't be all that bad. And he had not met some of the mandolin players from North Carolina, I had met, apparently. But no, they were all really supportive. My dad was not wild about music as a career, nor was he wild about me marrying a musician. You know, he really supported music, but he assumed, as most people did, that when I got out of college, you know, that I would do the responsible thing and get a real job. And it was somewhat of a painful decision to really commit to playing. And in some ways, I look around and I've been doing this now. I'm 42 and have been at this a long time, and I still don't even feel like I've really committed. It just has. I've been so blessed that it's just kind of happened. And the decision to not, you know, go to work and take some really great opportunities that were available after college, it was a big deal to make that transition and kind of take a leap of faith of, hey, I think I have to try this because I'm not sure I, you know, can be content without it.
Well, Kristen, it's safe to say a lot of musicians don't do music exclusively. They have another job. Unless you're in the music scene like Nashville or where you are, I mean, there are a lot of people that are still doing something on the side. So, you know, I can see your dad going, is this going to be enough? Will he be able to, you know,
sure.
make a living? So I can.
I completely understand his point of view, you know, and even we, you know, we consider teaching private lessons. That's essentially our day job. You know, it's what we do through the week because we mainly travel on the weekends. And certainly in non-mainstream genres, you're just full of musicians who are sometimes at the top of the game, but they're still doing other things through the week to make it work. And musicians tend to be, good multitaskers. So you have these various irons in the fire, and you just hope it kind of all adds up to, you know, to a living. And we've been really blessed to have that happen.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, let's talk a little bit about 4-time International Bluegrass Musician Banjo Player of the Year. That's, amazing. It's just so cool. It's such a big deal. What does it feel like to be a 4-time winner?
Yeah, I was completely shocked by that first nomination. And then when I won, I was just incredibly humbled. It was something that I never thought about. I never even, you know, thought it would be in the realm of possibility. So, you know, the thing that made me feel best about winning that the first time was really, that it's a peer-based organization. So it's your it's professional members voting for those awards. And, you know, regardless of how much I might love someone's musicianship, you know, it's really hard to cast a vote for someone that you don't think a lot of. So the thing that benefited me most is I thought, wow, I think I've developed some relationships, some real positive relationships for this to happen, because, you know, it's just it was a nice affirmation that the people that I had worked with knew me and you know, that I had become a part of the world that I grew up loving and admiring so much. So it was really nice.
Yeah, Kristen, talk about the demographics of bluegrass players. I mean, for a four-time banjo player of the year to be you, a woman, that's really a big deal. I mean, I know you're just an exceptional player, but is it still kind of a male-dominated field? Or?
Yeah, it is, but it's quickly changing. When I first started playing banjo for Larry Stevenson, who was really my first band that played a lot and was out and about, it was very rare. You would see women fronting their own band. So maybe they were the lead singer or the band leader. Maybe you would see an all-girl band, which I was a part of one of those when I was in high school. But you didn't normally see women in groups who were just, you know, there randomly. They just got a job to play the banjo or whatever instrument. So it was a novelty at the time. And it's just as everything else has changed, bluegrass has changed as well. And I really believe you'd be hard-pressed to find very many brand-new bands that don't have women as members. So it's become much more common and certainly more diversified than it was 20 years ago. But, you know, I would love to see some racial diversity. Unfortunately, however male-dominated it has been, it is certainly, you know, very much in the audience and within on the music side of things, very much a white people's music. And I would love to see there are people like Renan and Giddens, who is a banjo player, and she's fantastic. And she's very much not bluegrass. She's more on the fringe of acoustic music in general. But, you know, we're seeing some of that occur as well. And that makes me happy, because the banjo originally is an African instrument. So it would be nice to integrate, you know, some of those folks and tie it back into its original roots.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Kristen Scott Benson. She is a four-time winner of the Bluegrass Music Association's Banjo Player of the Year. In 2018, this year, she won the Steve Martin Award for Excellence in Banjo, which I know that Steve has been giving out for only a couple of years. What was it like winning that award?
That was certainly a wonderful surprise. And I was at Bela Fleck's house, who is, by most people's standards, you know, truly the most wonderful musician in the world, who plays the banjo, and in walks Noam Pikelny and Allison Brown, two other
wow,
fantastic players, and all three of them are heroes of mine. And when they walked through the door, I was a bit confused, and they didn't make me squirm long, though. Allison let me know that I had won the Steve Martin Award this year, and, you know, just so thankful for it.
Very exciting. Talk about the Grascals, your band.
Yeah, the Grascals is a group based out of Nashville, Tennessee, and they formed, I believe, in 2004 or 5, and then I joined the group in 2008. And so it's been my home musically for a little over 10 years now. And so those guys have, you know, just truly become family. I mean, there are parts of the times of the year that I'm with them more than I'm at home. So it's been a great experience, and, you know, wonderful guys to play with. Three of the guys who started the band, who are still there, you know, I grew up seeing play. So that's always a nice thing when you can get to, you know, play with guys that inspired you when you were growing up.
Yeah, no kidding. I saw Noam Pikelny last year, sat in the front row, and I don't think I've been quite so mesmerized in a long, long time.
Did you see his solo show?
Yes, I did. It was insane.
Yeah, I went to see that when he was in Asheville, North Carolina, and I was so I have no right to be proud of him, but I was. I was just so proud to see someone entertains so effectively with the banjo. And we all know he's, you know, just this genius of a musician. But to see him handle a crowd so
he's
well
hysterical.
And just be hilarious. Yes, I was so proud of him.
Yeah. Kristen, talk about the way music is so important to our heads and our hearts, and how it is just makes us feel so much better.
Yeah, it really can be good medicine, can't it?
Oh, and, absolutely.
You know, I mentioned that I teach lessons through the week, and that's turned out to be such a surprising blessing in our lives, because it's easy, and I think my husband and I both have done a good job not becoming too jaded or ungrateful for the rare gift of getting to play music for a living. But it is easy to get somewhat numb to the things that originally attract you to an instrument or to a genre when you're young. And by teaching folks, it's very much connected me to how it felt when I first started playing, and it rejuvenates me, and I really, truly enjoy seeing other people enjoy the banjo. And when I see a student make huge progress in their playing, and I see the joy that brings, and also just, you know, some of the more mundane elements of playing an instrument. You know, I see people who are older, who are keeping their mind sharp by learning to play this instrument. And there are so many ways that music can bless us. And I love seeing banjo be a part of that, and I love playing a role in that for people.
I love when I see banjo in worship services, because I see that on occasion,
mm-hmm.
and that just makes me so very happy.
Mm-hmm.
We've just got about a little over a minute, so I'm going to let your ears be thrilled with what you're about to hear, which is Kristen Scott Benson playing. This is a cut off her album called Stringworks, and this is called Traveler's Rest. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Show, you know, it's interesting whenever Kristen and I pick up a banjo, money changes hands. When she plays, people buy tickets to see her perform and buy her CDs. And when I pick up the banjo, people buy noise cancellation headphones. So, you know, there's always something going on. But she is my guest on our studio line, and you've been hearing some of that spectacular music. And if you're a bluegrass fan or a banjo fan, you know how excited I am right now to be talking to her. So, Kristen, when you have had so many opportunities to perform, what gives the goosebumps? What gets it for you? Is it being on the Grand Ole Opry stage, or is it being on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno? What was it?
You know, it's none of that. It's never the more high-profile things that we do for me. What means the most to me, what tickles me the most is, you know, when someone like J.D. Crowe, who is a banjo icon,
right,
apparently someone, or Sonny Osborne, you mm-hmm. know, people like that. We're getting to know Bela Fleck through his Blue Ridge banjo camp. You know, getting to know the people who inspired you so much when you're young, I think that's my favorite thing about it's the definitely the instances where I need to pinch myself
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm getting to know some of these folks who are really the giants and the icons for this instrument. And mm-hmm. I think that always will mean more to me than more of the, you know, more of the high profile things that are so much less personal than getting to know your musical heroes.
Kristen, when I was younger and I started watching the Andy Griffith Show, of course, I started to fall in love with bluegrass right away because of the Dillards. And I was wondering, it seems like bluegrass music seems to represent so much of what's right in the world, even to this day.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's still and always is a big, strong faith community among bluegrass players. Do you find that to be true?
I agree. And there's just a purity about the music. And it's kind of bizarre because, for instance, one of the songs that our band does is White Lightning, which, of course, is a song about moonshine. It's a George Jones song. And we have had little tiny kids who are 5 or 6 years old get up on stage with us and sing that. And it feels weird in a way to, you know, as a Christian to do some of those songs who are like that. But it's like bluegrass somehow is able to retain a purity, even if you're doing a song that, you know, which that's a funny song because our lead singer, you know, can make all the funny sounds. And I think that's why the little kids are tickled by it. But there's just a purity about the music itself, I think. And I find this constantly with the young people who are interested in it. As a rule, the teenagers who love to play bluegrass are such great kids, you know, and it's just so reassuring when you get to know these guys, and they're, you know, they just have such good hearts. One of the musicians I'm proudest of is a young lady named Carly Arrowwood, and she's probably 21 or 2 now, but she came to the house for lessons when she was younger, and she's doing very well. She's out and about playing professionally, and she has met a young man, and you know, they talk to each other that morning about what scripture they want to read, and then they talk about it that night before they go to bed on the phone, you know, and it's encouraging, and I see that time and time again with young people who love bluegrass. I see it accompanied by a strong faith relationship, and I love that.
When you have conversations with God, do you often say to him, thank you for what you've enabled my fingers to do?
Oh, gosh, I thank him for a lot more than that. And you know, rarely do we get through a show where I don't say, where I don't thank Jesus. You know, it happens, I would say, almost every show where there will be a moment where I just say, thank you, Lord, for, you know, the chance to, and that's all I say to him because he knows what I'm thanking him for, but just for the chance to be there. And I look at the guys I'm beside and I care for them so much. And, you know, it really is a dream come true to get to do this. And we are blessed to have the sense to give the praise where it belongs, and that's with Jesus.
Yeah, that's outstanding, Kristen. And when I think of the humility that you have and just the desire you have just to, you know, play with excellence, which God has enabled you to do, and then you go out and do it, that attracts everyone's attention, you know, including Steve Martin, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, well, we all have a platform, and it varies, and for each of us, but it's there for each of us. And for some moms who feel so isolated with young kids and, you know, they're just at home most of the day, oh, my word, what a platform that is to influence her kids second to second throughout their day. So it absolutely doesn't matter how many people you're reaching or touching. We all have, you know, avenues to talk. And that's another thing that's been great about teaching lessons for me. It's a chance to gain a far more personal relationship with folks than you ever will just meeting them at shows. And it's turned into some of the greatest relationships I have that I'm most thankful for. So I just believe that we should, you know, just all be available to, and it can get tricky. Sometimes I fear that I'm not bold enough, you know, but then I look, which Paul always got around to the gospel, and sometimes it got him beaten and thrown out of towns and everything else, and sometimes I worry I'm not bold enough. But, you know, I look at how he approached people, and he catered his message to whoever he was with at the time. And our goal is to be effective, and I hope it's not a cop-out, but I just try to make my faith available to people and let them know how I feel. And I find usually, not always, but usually we will get around to those conversations if you just are that quiet, steady influence. You will usually get around to talking about the most important things in life if you're patient. And so I just, have really enjoyed being able to do that in a way as a banjo teacher that I might not be able to when you're just playing shows and you're in one place and then you're gone.
Mm. I know you are familiar with hard work and discipline because you have to be at your level. And I remember hearing Pablo Casals, the great cellist, being interviewed. I think he was about 86, and he was practicing 6 hours a day. And somebody said to him, Mr. Casals, why do you practice 6 hours a day still? You're 86. And he said, because I think I'm getting better.
Oh, God bless him. That is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and isn't that encouraging? You know, one of the things I've mentioned to a mutual friend of ours is he's very much a patriarch in his family. I think he's been a really successful guy. And I love, he brings his grandkids up to say hello if they're around when he's taking a banjo lesson. And I love that those young people and the kids and even his grown adult children, they all see him still learning. You know, the guy that could seemingly have all the answers and have accomplished everything that you could hope to accomplish, they see him still pursuing something and getting better at it and practicing. And those are such valuable lessons, and I love to see people model that.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, I want to direct all of our listeners to your website, which is outstanding, ksbbanjo.com, and there is some items available there, and the one that I was talking about, Stringworks, which is a release of yours, is fantastic, and you can sample all the music there. It is so good. You're amazing.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I just love the fact that you love the Lord, and you want to always be aware of taking every opportunity you have to make a difference for the kingdom and let the world know that your talent is on loan from Him.
Oh, and that's absolutely the case, and we're just so thankful, and I appreciate you, inviting me on.
Well, my last question would be with your husband, Wayne, who's a mandolin player, how much music is going on in your house every day?
A surprisingly small amount together.
Yeah.
Because we do teach a lot. So many times, I'm in one room, he's in another room, and we're, we're teaching. And then our son gets home from school, and he is not musical, and we try to cater to him and be with him as much as possible. But when we do play together, a lot of times we switch, and he'll play the banjo and I'll play the mandolin. Neither of us are very good at the other, so that makes for a more entertaining session than playing our regular instruments. But with that being said, music in general, is always around the house before before our son gets home. If we aren't playing ourselves or teaching, we'll just have some music on. It's just an ever-present, thing that's a part of our lives.
Mm-hmm. All right, Kristen, I picked the first song, Traveler's Rest, and the song that we're going to go out with would be what? What would you like us to go out with?
Well, let's go to the opposite end of the spectrum in the Great Waterton.
All right, we'll go to the Great Waterton. Kristen Scott Benson has been my guest. And you're listening to The Great Waterton by Kristen Scott Benson. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. Wraps up our show. What a great day. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for your support of Faith Radio. I love all my listeners. Thank you so much for all the great feedback you send into the studio. I just appreciate you very, very much. But have a great weekend, everyone. I'll see you Monday. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.